This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a possible ISIS helper is discovered in Charlotte, and the accused is arrested for attempting to set up a sleeper cell. A federal appeals court strikes down North Carolina's voter ID law, calling it unconstitutional and saying its provisions deliberately target African Americans with almost surgical precision. Meanwhile, another court considers suspending HB 2 while various lawsuits wind their way through the courts. And the court's ruling on voter ID seems to make an even more important battleground for candidates. And we'll look at the impact of that on races down the ballot. Our panel of reporters is ready to talk about those and many other stories today. And we're joined by WFAE's Sarah D'Elia and WBTV's Nick Oxner. We can only hope.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hillary Burns is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, and dodging the wrecking ball to get here is, is the Charlotte Observer's editorial writer, Eric Frazier. Good morning and welcome to you, too.
Good morning.
We're going to talk about that in a little while.
Sure.
A 35-year-old Eric Jamal Hendricks was arrested yesterday here in Charlotte and accused of trying to recruit potential terrorists in the United States and planning to set up a training compound in Arkansas, I believe. He allegedly has ties to an attack in Texas in 2015, and the FBI has been following him since then. So why did they arrest him yesterday? What do we know about this?
Oh, that's a good question. It's as is often the case with these FBI investigations. They don't tell you all of the backstory about why they
right.
moved when they did but one would suspect that they felt like this guy is about to perhaps, you know, do something we wouldn't like him to do, because so, that's always something that they struggle with when they're doing these undercover investigations. When do you, you know, how much information is enough, and when does it get to the point where, okay, we better stop this guy before he
on these kinds of cases. I actually met my now wife covering a trial of a now convicted terrorist in Texas in a sleeper cell plot. And the thing that we found then that they struggled with, and I think the FBI and Department of Justice struggle with this frequently as a matter of course in these investigations, is you have to actually build up enough evidence to make your case that they wanted to do this bad act of terrorism that you're trying to convict them for. So they have to let them get far enough down the road so you build up your case and you can prove that they were really going to do this. And I think it is a really, really fine line between how far do you let them go and when do you finally, you know, bring them in and slap the cuffs on them.
So what do we know about Eric Jamal Hendricks?
Well, he's very recently moved to Charlotte about three weeks ago,
yeah.
I think it was. He grew up in Arkansas, claimed to have some land there that he wanted to create a training compound.
Spent time in Virginia and South Carolina as
well,
I believe.
Yeah, also there. Certainly kind of an odd profile for an ISIS sympathizer. He doesn't, I guess he's Muslim, but he doesn't seem to fit the normal profile, being, you know, somebody who's he looks like he probably was a convert to Islam as well.
Criminal record?
No criminal record, not a significant one.
But he was pretty active on social media, so that's where a lot of the evidence they found was talking to people in Texas on social media, which we know is a common thread.
It is a common thread with a lot of these guys, and that's how a lot of them get caught. I mean,
it's amazing that they haven't figured out, don't talk on social media when you want to plot a terrorist plot.
He claims to have recruited 10 members to his group. The FBI, we are to assume, knows who they are. Have they rounded them up? Are they about to? Is that generally what happens in these situations, or do we know, or is it all different because everything is different? Every case is different.
Well, generally, every case is different and unique. I haven't heard that they've made any other arrests, but you would think that they either have either they know who the other people are, or they are trying to find out, one would hope, who the other people are. And they found out about this guy by, you know, through another guy who says that this guy was trying to recruit him. So that's kind of how they sort of unravel these plots. They'll find one guy, flip him, and then use him as a confidential informant to try and turn the other guy. So you would think that this particular guy, he is probably also being asked to cooperate and inform on whoever his other people were.
Right. That was the other interesting thing I was going to bring up is, yeah, this was actually investigated from the federal apparatus in Ohio, because that's where this, mm-hmm. this all started and linked to. So, and kind of made its tentacles down here to Charlotte.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll follow that story as it continues to unravel here. By unanimous decision, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit this week struck down North Carolina's 2013 voter ID laws. The court decided that the law selectively chose voter ID requirements, reduced the number of early voting days, changed registration procedures, all in ways meant to harm blacks who overwhelmingly vote for the Democratic Party. And Judge Diana Gribben-Motz wrote, the new provisions target African Americans with almost surgical precision and impose cures for problems that did not exist. Thus, the asserted justifications cannot and do not conceal the state's true motivation. What did she say the state's true motivation was?
Well, to restrict or to tamp down African American voting. You had a Republican legislature looking at a situation in which the overwhelming majority of black people in North Carolina tend to vote Democratic, and they were, according to the ruling, they were trying to bring down that level of black voter participation. Now, the judge in the lower court basically said that this is just, you know, that's just partisan politics. You know, that's just kind of politics. You know, one party is trying to gain partisan advantage. That's not a violation of the, you know, Voting Rights Act. But these judges at the higher level, at the Fourth Circuit, basically said that this judge, and I think the phrase they used, that he was he missed the forest because he was so carefully surveying the individual trees. They said that even if that is partisan politics, if your partisan politics have race and racial sort of undertone sort of intertwined in them, that is impermissible. And so they very emphatically struck down the lower court ruling.
And this happened in another state as well. Was it Wisconsin?
I believe so, yeah. I think Wisconsin.
Although Republicans have been quick to point out that in other states where the courts have either altered voter ID or looked for voter ID tests, legislative Republicans would be quick to say that other federal courts in other states have actually adopted rules that more closely resemble the North Carolina legislation, which then this week obviously has been, I think emphatically would be an appropriate term, struck down by the Fourth Circuit. So it's very interesting that these laws are all very different across the country, and Republicans say North Carolina has been held up as a model.
Well, does it matter that North Carolina was recently removed from the list of states that had to be watched carefully because of previous racial discrimination? And
that's part of the history of how this all came about, in that when North Carolina was removed from that list, then the legislature took action, and the lower court said, well, that's just partisan political action, but the higher court said, no, that's not permissible.
Well, as we all know, North Carolina was already considered to be a pivotal state in the presidential election that's coming up. What impact might this ruling have on that election?
I think it emboldens Democrats a little bit. This is a big victory for them in a time when they've been scoring some victories. You know, Attorney General Roy Cooper, who's, of course, the Democratic nominee for governor against Pat McCrory, the Republican, on Tuesday, as he talked about this, said, you know, look, Republicans need to stop passing legislation that gets overturned by courts. And so far, and you know, this will probably go to the Supreme Court and what, but so far, that's a very valid argument for if you're a Democrat running this year, is you need to elect us so that, you know, we can stop these Republicans. Now, the Republicans would very much disagree with that. So, you know, I think that will very much, I don't know what effect it'll have on the top of the ticket in the presidential race, but I think it will very much have an impact on the state level.
Yeah, we were talking to a Democratic representative, Alma Adams, this week, and I asked her that specific question, what do you think the impact will be on specifically black voter turnout? And she said she's looking for this to increase black voter turnout by 6 to 8%.
That's significant.
That's significant, especially in a state like North Carolina, where you're talking about a presidential race that's pretty much a toss-up right now.
Why 6 to 8%? Is it simply that they will no longer have to present voter ID, a picture ID, or is it because of the early voting schedule?
I think it's more the early voting than the voter ID part. You have this tradition of black churches doing these souls to the polls things on Sundays, where they, after church, load up the church bus and take all these people to the polls, most of whom, you know, will overwhelmingly vote Democratic.
And the first year that happened, back in 2012? I'm pretty sure it's 2012. But the first year that happened, President Obama, in his reelection, came to Fayetteville, North Carolina on a Sunday to highlight just how important. So if you want to see how critical Democrats think, you know, that souls to the polls movement is, we saw the president here in 12 in his reelect highlighting that in the state. So.
Well, Alma Adams, I take it, thinks that this will also help the down ballot races. What impact might this have, for instance, on either the Richard Burr, Deborah Ross senatorial race, or the really tight race that we seem to be running between Pat McCrory and Attorney General Roy Cooper?
You would think it would have some impact. It's kind of hard to say specifically, because you never know if people will split their tickets when they get in the voting booth or not. But you would have to think that it will have an impact.
It's interesting to note that the court used a Daily Show with Jon Stewart segment, which I actually saw when it was on the air and thought, you've got to be kidding. They surely edited this to make this man look like an idiot.
Surprisingly hip for you, Mike.
I love the Daily Show. I don't know who you think I am. Evidently they didn't. It was featured Buncombe County precinct captain who told the show that the law was essentially racialized. Don Yelton was his name. He says on that show that if North Carolina voter ID law hurts the whites, so be it. If it hurts a bunch of lazy blacks that want government to give them everything, so be it. Wow. To which the Daily Show's correspondent Asif Manvi asked, you know we can hear you, right?
Just perfect comedic timing. You know, just great.
And he said, yeah.
And he had to resign.
Well, I think, look, let's be clear here, right, is that there is a difference between a precinct chaplain or what was Don Young, the party chair. I mean, he'd been around the party apparatus a little bit, right, but he was not a lawmaker. You know, and so I think it is – and the court – Governor McCrory certainly, in his remarks on Tuesday about the ruling, took great umbrage with the fact that the court used Comedy Central, citing its court opinion. But I also think it is probably pretty important to say that Don Yelton, the precinct captain or the party chair in Asheville, probably doesn't speak for, you know, Phil Berger and Tim Moore.
And in fact, the current Buncombe County GOP chairman, Nathan West, said that Yelton is like a chronic case of hemorrhoids, a real pain in the ass that you could never seem to get rid of. Those are his words.
It's hard to ignore.
But what was important, I thought, about that was that the court used that as sort of a symbol of the racialized sort of backdrop. You know, there are these people out there like him.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll come back, talk a little bit more about that, and move on to some other court decisions as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally, Summer of 69 No Apostrophe Tour, August 10th at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available at LiveNation.com. Traffic in Charlotte becomes more congested with every passing year. Some think that part of the answer is more bicycles, and the city has been working for years to become more bicycle friendly. Still, it can be dangerous for bicycles to share the road with automobiles. Sustain Charlotte is working and has been working to bring protected bike lanes to uptown, providing a separate space for cyclists, a kind of buffer between motorists and people on bicycles. And we'll hear more about that on this program Monday at 9. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. More Republicans question whether to support Donald Trump for president. The FBI continues to investigate a hack of Democratic National Committee emails and the latest on a Zika outbreak in Miami.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It is the local news roundup here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Sarah DeLeer from WFAE News, Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV, Hillary Burns, staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. We've been talking about the unanimous three-judge panel's decision with the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn the state's voter ID law. The state is obviously going to appeal this, correct?
Correct.
Yes, but not with the help of the Attorney General. Jump ahead of your question, but I'll let you ask it.
I was going to say, once again, how did you know that Attorney General Roy Cooper, who's already not defending the HB2 lawsuits, says he will no longer defend the state's voter ID law? Which brings up, I think, a valid question that the governor has been asking, but can an Attorney General's office continue to refuse to defend the state that his office exists to represent?
Apparently.
It is starting to look a little weird. Yeah.
This is not the first or second time that the Attorney General's office has done this. But I think what makes this – so HB 2, House Bill 2, the Attorney General's office said from the very start of that legislation, like they did on some others, no, we're not going to defend this. What makes this one a little bit different is that they did defend the law in court up through the appellate level, and now his office has said, well, we're just not going to do anything else. And so I think it's very strange when you have someone who has worked on behalf of the state, as he's constitutionally required to do, to defend the law, to now say, eh. And that's, what the governor was criticizing him for this week. And
It's a fair criticism.
Yeah. Is it because the federal government is involved and federal law trumps state law, or is it because of something, or is it because of politics?
Well, the federal government has been involved the entire time. Yeah. I think it's because he got a Republicans on Tuesday when this announcement were made were quick to point out that and quick to accuse him of working up until he got a favorable ruling that he wanted in his campaign this year, and now he's going to stop. Of course, it's an election year. It's a tightly contested race, so you could probably point to literally everything that those two men are doing and accuse them of being politically motivated. But that's what Republicans are
saying. Well, as you mentioned, Pat McCrory has been using Cooper's refusal to defend the state against HB2 against him in the gubernatorial race. And now with his refusal to defend the state over voter ID, he has questioned whether he should take a paycheck anymore. The governor continued, if any North Carolina citizen decided not to do their job, they would no longer have a paycheck. Is that what he said about other state officials and certain magistrates when they were refusing to perform same-sex marriages?
Well, I guess.
Good question.
I see your point there. Yeah.
I'm just asking. All right. So how will this play back and forth in the gubernatorial race? Is this a winner or a loser for which candidate?
Well, I was going to say, too, if the state does appeal, doesn't that create a lot of uncertainty as we come right up to game time here?
More uncertainty. Let's not say a lot, because that sounds like there isn't any already.
That's true.
And that is important, because that's what the Attorney General's office said. Look, if we appeal this more, it's going to create more. It's going to create uncertainty. This has been an election filled with uncertainty. Do we have voter ID? Don't we have voter ID? When am I voting? Who am I voting for? Right? It's almost like have the federal courts thought about what they're doing to North Carolina voters as they make their rulings? And I don't really think they care.
Well, should they? I mean, aren't they focused on the law?
Well, that's a good point. Good question. And maybe the better argument would be that no, they shouldn't care. However, at some point you have to think about our poor friends at the Board of Elections in Raleigh, right, who are really tasked with executing whatever they say. So if you look at the first election that we had with voter ID was what, in March, correct? Mm-hmm. And generally by all accounts it went fine. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can talk about the broader issues that obviously the court addressed, right? But I think if you're talking about in a practical way, because they just denied this in the last day or two, they denied stalling this. So if you look and say, what is the practical effect going to be on this law going through the rest of the year that you've already planned for and people are already used to, I think one could have made a reasonable argument that, you know, let's just hold off on implementing this.
So this is a weapon that both sides can use. Both the attorney general in his race for governor and the governor in his race for reelection can use this weapon. Who is it likely to benefit, these two weapons in the arsenal, that he's not defending these two court cases? Is it a plus for Roy Cooper or a negative for Roy Cooper?
I think it's probably a wash because, I mean, you know, I think Governor McCrory's argument that he shouldn't take a paycheck if he's going to consistently keep, you know, refusing to defend the state, you know, that to the average person who works for the paycheck that they get, that, you know, that hits home. But then on the other side, you can see, you know, where Cooper tactically, this is smart politics for him tactically.
So a number
of the real winners are the private lawyers in Raleigh who are going to be hired by the state to defend this.
I was going to ask, how much is this? How much would this cost the state?
A lot of money, and it will cost taxpayers a lot of money. I mean, HB2 defense. There was a recent, I think, story done by the News and Observer. It cost a lot of money. Yeah. Private attorneys billing hourly, and they don't just go hire some schlub, you know. So
explain to me how it is that the attorney general's office is obviously independent of legislative or gubernatorial oversight.
Yeah, he's a constitutional officer. He's elected separately from the governor. Mm-hmm. He is seen as having, you know, sort of the same sort of statewide vote of confidence/legitimacy from the voters as the governor or any other, you know, constitutionally elected office in North Carolina. So, yeah, that's the way we've chosen to do it.
Okay.
It looks a little odd right now, but that is the way
we are very strange because we have 10 statewide elected offices, which all have their independent autonomy, and that's more than most states in the country. It's very, very different.
Including the woman who runs all the elevators. her picture's in all of the elevators.
Sherry Berry.
That's right. Republican lawmakers continue to assert that the voter ID law was an effort to suppress voter fraud, despite the fact that there has been no evidence of that anywhere, pretty much in the country. And in an editorial in the Observer, you wrote, I'm not sure you wrote it, Eric, but the paper wrote,
we'll let people guess.
The fraud we needed to be protected from is what happened in the General Assembly when they passed the voter ID law. What kind of reaction did you guys get to that comment?
Well, I mean, people tend to know where we stand, you know, sort of on the
from all your friends in the Republican Party.
Yeah. They loved it, as they love all our editorials. They thought it was fair and valid.
So. All right. You write, we'll decide. Let's move on to HB2 because HB2 is still in the news. It will never go away. The federal judge who will decide on whether HB2, the infamous bathroom bill, should be suspended while lawsuits go through the court, started asking questions about it this week. What did he want to know?
I thought he had some good questions. He asked, so do we really – is this an issue that we're worried about people being assaulted in the bathroom? Because that's not allowed right now, you know. And I don't know how anyone answered that, but it's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
The other good question he asked was, if there's no enforcement mechanism, what is the point of having the law?
That I thought was the best question of all. Yeah. Why? Why are we even doing all this if it's not important enough to actually arrest somebody over?
Yeah.
Right.
You spoke, Hillary, this week with State Senator Jeff Jackson. He's a Democrat who represents.
I saw him speak. I didn't speak with him.
He represents Mecklenburg County in the General Assembly. He said that HB2 hurts the state's ability to compete as an innovation hub, but more troublingly is that he talked about the state being able to benefit mightily from technological changes coming our way, but he seemed to paint a picture of a General Assembly not equipped to deal with the changes.
And he did it all without ever saying HB2. It was pretty impressive. But he was talking to a group of entrepreneurs and technologists over at UNCC for an Internet of Things event. So the crowd there obviously want to advance technology, and state senator stood up and said, we could really benefit from that. I don't know if you know, but the state government has some inefficiencies. And then at the end he said, but we need in turn to support these ecosystems so we have new technologies in the future to benefit from. And maybe one thing we could do was stop passing legislation, I quote, that gives the middle finger to tech companies. He got an understanding, or not standing, but he got a lot of applause for that.
But so. He mentioned that isn't he a member of the technology commission?
Yeah, and he said that they don't meet very often, and when they do, that he said a lot of them are still caught up with the moon landing. They're not talking about what you think that they
They're
should
very
be
very impressed with the moon landing.
Yep.
And we have more power in our smartphones than the computer on the Apollo landing module had back then. Meanwhile, Governor McCrory allowed a bill to become law without his signature that transfers money from the Disaster Relief Fund to a fund for costs arising from litigation over HB2. And the governor's spokesperson said that the governor would have preferred the money come from the Attorney General's budget since he's refusing to do his job. Why didn't it come from the Attorney General's budget?
Well, I guess some of the same stuff we've been talking about. Roy Cooper says he won't.
No, but I mean, if the legislature has passed a bill that channels money from one fund to another, why can't they channel money from one department to another?
They could, but I don't think it is wise to try to figure out what they do on Jones Street. I stopped trying to guess that a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, had the governor come, well, who knows how much it is debatable how much power and influence the governor wields in any North Carolina legislature, let alone this session. But, you know, I don't know that the governor was on record as having asked for that during budget negotiations. Mm-hmm. Would be interesting to know.
This became law without the governor's signature. Is there anything to be made of that?
I didn't make a whole lot out of that. I mean, you know, he's either way, he's green lighting it, right. You know, with the signature or without.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine was in Greensboro this week. Sarah, he spoke to WFAE's Mark Rumsey. What did he have to say?
Well, he had a lot of things to say. He wanted to talk about the improving economy under the Democratic Party over the last few years. You know, Mark asked a lot of poignant questions, asking Tim Kaine, you know, what do you say to North Carolinians that are frustrated because of the economy or because of their health care or their Second Amendment rights? And Tim Kaine said that he heard those frustrations. Part of how they plan to combat those is just to have him and Hillary Clinton have a stronger presence in North Carolina leading up to the election. And Tim Kaine also pointed out that he's a gun owner himself and is a supporter of the Second Amendment right, and that, you know, he supports everyone's right to bear arms, but that there needs to be stronger regulations with that.
He also defended Hillary Clinton on the trust issue. What is there left to say about that?
Well, I think, he said him being a vice presidential candidate puts him in a unique position to say things and brag about Hillary Clinton in a way that she can't brag about herself. And that's the role that he sees himself taking as a vice president. And he also said that, he is prepared to draw. He doesn't call himself an attack dog. He called himself an upbeat warrior for Hillary Clinton, which is maybe a nice way to say attack dog.
He doesn't have to go after Donald Trump.
Right.
He can build up Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. So he's prepared to draw these contrasts between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And he said at the end of the day, Hillary Clinton is passionate about the issues and Donald Trump is passionate about himself. And that's the kind of contrast that he wants to draw out when he's talking in states like North Carolina that are battleground states.
They are going to be coming here a lot in the coming months because this is a battleground state. And Hillary Clinton has evidently risen in the polls since the convention and because of some gaffes that have been going on in the Trump campaign. Do we know how she's doing in North Carolina and how Trump is doing in North Carolina?
Well, Civitas just put out a poll that showed Trump up 4. I don't know if that polling was all post convention or if it took into account Donald Trump's horrible, terrible, no good, awful week this week. I think there's some children's book.
It's a children's book. Yeah. Yes.
I think what's interesting is there's not been a terribly large amount of polling in North Carolina yet, even though we are arguably one of the top 4 battleground states in the country. And so it's hard for us to get a gauge both in the presidential and in the gubernatorial and in the senatorial race. I think we'll see more of that as we move forward now. I think Elon will start polling more. public policy will start polling more. You know, we have the monthly Civitas poll. But it's really been hard to get a real good grasp, because even now when you see these averages of North Carolina over time from these, you know, respected outlets of aggregators, they're really taking into account a lot of old polls because there's just not been a lot.
Well, if you take into account the Tim Kaine's visit and Mike Pence's visit and who appeared with him, you would have to think that the internal polling is not looking that great for Trump, because Kaine drew both Deborah Ross and Roy Cooper. Mm-hmm. They both appeared with him. Mike Pence, no Burr, no McCrory. Neither appeared with him. Hmm. So you get a pretty clear sense of which party thinks the wind is at their back right now.
Well, nationally, the week seemed to be consumed, at least the week's news can seem to be consumed, with gaffes and missteps and questionable quips made by the Republican nominee. Chief among them was his combative stance against Kazir and Ghazala Khan. I hope I said their names correctly, the Gold Star family that spoke at the Democratic convention. Mr. Khan, obviously critical of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has shot back and will not let go of this. Some people believe it's the media that won't let this go because we keep hammering away at this. But a lot of veterans see it differently. And Nick, you are, and I didn't know this about you, you are a Gold Star son. You lost your father to a roadside bomb in Afghanistan in 2005. So put on your reporter hat for just a second and talk about media coverage of this one gaffe.
Mm-hmm.
Take that hat off and talk about it again as somebody who is a Gold Star family member.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first, as a reporter, it's not one gaffe because he keeps talking about it over and over, right? And so generally, we have these 24-hour news cycles, and the Trump campaign you know, continues to perpetuate that news cycle by responding and responding again and hitting them, you know, again. As a Gold Star son, as someone who lost my father in Afghanistan, and not as a reporter, I'll say that Donald Trump's remarks were offensive, absolutely offensive, and I think shows a lack of understanding about what it means, particularly when he talked about the sacrifices that he has made. It shows just an absolute lack of basic understanding of what it's like to have sacrificed for this country, and I think it was really tone deaf, and I would challenge him to sit down with some Gold Star family members. I understand he did at some point this week, and actually take a second to recognize what that loss really
meant. And it came a week after his appearance at the VFW convention in Charlotte, where he was cheered, and she was
very
politely
well received. Yes. That's correct. Very. Mm-hmm. I was sitting there as he was very.
Had that quip taken place before the VFW, what would the reaction have been to him, you think?
Well, the VFW put out a very swift rebuke of Donald Trump's remarks about the Gold Star family. I thought it was a very interesting contrast. One week, you know, and of course the VFW has a very wide array of members who all think different things, and those members were the ones cheering for him when he was here, not the VFW. But I think the reception would have been significantly different.
You can go to, by the way, to the WBTV website and look at a wonderful piece that Nick's wife put together about Nick and his mother, and you can also read an essay that Nick wrote about the real meaning of Memorial Day, which will take your breath away.
Well, thank you.
We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, providing comprehensive services and customized treatment plans. More at novanthealth.org/orthopedics. And Honda of Concord, committed to customer service satisfaction and bringing excellence to the car buying experience, offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles. Details at hondaofconcord.com. The weekly news roundup continues on the other side of the news at 10 o'clock with Diane Rehm and her panel of journalists bringing you up to date on the national news. More Republicans question whether to support Donald Trump for president. The FBI continues to investigate a hack of Democratic National Committee emails. And the latest on the Zika outbreak in Miami, the International Hour will follow at 11 o'clock. And if you'd like to join our conversation, chime in on the news, you can. Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. On Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup or WFAE on Facebook. We're coming right back.
The news can sometimes be overwhelming.
Hollande said France was under attack.
A police officer killing a child. Terrorism and violence can be long planned or it can be almost instantaneous.
Syrian refugees here being put under a magnifying glass.
All Things Considered is here to help you make sense of it all. Listen every afternoon.
I'm Mark Rumsey. Tune in for All Things Considered weekdays beginning at 4 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local weekly news roundup here on Charlotte Talks. Sarah D'Elia is with us from WFAE News. Hillary Burns, staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV. And Eric Frazier, editorial writer with the Charlotte Observer. I want to talk about the CMS board meeting on Tuesday to talk about a number of issues. But before we talk about that, CMS yesterday, I believe it was, put on hold their transgender restroom rules after the Supreme Court ruled that a Virginia school board could block a transgender male student from using the boys' room. Now, CMS had planned this fall when they opened the schools to allow transgender students to use the bathroom with which they identify. They said it was not a reaction to HB2, that it had been in the planning stages for a very long time. The reversal, strictly because of Virginia, they knew that they would be shot down as well?
That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
So basically the plans that they had to allow transgender students to use the bathroom of their gender identity, that's not going forward. So they will have to use the bathroom of the gender on their birth certificate.
Is this a temporary stay until the HB2 thing can be decided?
Yeah, it's a temporary thing. I think at the Supreme Court level, which justice was it that went over to the other side? I think it was Ginsburg, who basically broke ranks with the more liberal justices and said that he was going to vote to put this on hold. That is the Virginia case and the Virginia, you know, situation where the transgender kid was trying to use the bathroom of his gender identity. Ginsburg said he was putting that on hold until. Wait a minute, no, not Ginsburg. She's a she.
She.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so much for my knowledge of Supreme Court.
Pay no attention to what he said.
Anyway.
One of the more liberal justices.
Well, one of them.
Went to the other side.
Right, right. Okay. And basically it's on hold until that can be more fully heard at the Supreme Court level.
Borrow my phone, use Google, look it up.
My apologies to Justice Ginsburg.
The CMS board met on Tuesday to talk about proposals on how to use magnet schools to help break up pockets of poverty. We talked about this on this program earlier this week with Andos Helms from The Observer and our own reporter whose name is skipping my mind at
Lisa
the moment.
Lisa Wharf.
Lisa Wharf, I'm so sorry.
I'll let you borrow my phone to look it up.
This is phase one of a process and one that will include lots of meetings with parents this month. So before they could discuss proposals on that, they had to figure out how to measure a student's socioeconomic status. And that actually surprised me, Sarah. They haven't done this before?
Right. No, they haven't done this before. So this is kind of new territory. And what they're trying to figure out – so they want to bring diversity to these magnet schools that – don't always have the most diverse populations within their schools. And so they decided socioeconomic status was how they were going to do this. But what does socioeconomic status mean? What are the factors that go into that? That's what they discussed, and that's what they need to decide in order to have this definition and then create a new lottery system by November.
But don't they have a definition for people who, for instance, take advantage of free school lunch and breakfast and things like that? Do they have that definition?
Well, they do, but the problem is that there have been so many – in some of the schools, there have been such a large percentage of students who get free and reduced lunch. That's how they've used free and reduced lunch as sort of the income marker. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But in some schools, so many kids get it that they've just decided to just give it to all of the kids so that they don't have to deal with all this paperwork when virtually every kid gets it. So that's sort of made it an more imprecise marker because of that.
So if I understood this correctly when I read this, one of the things they're thinking about is having parents self-identify by filling out some sort of survey and talking about income levels. Is that likely to happen? Are parents going to be willing to sit down and fill out a form that identifies them as socioeconomically underprivileged?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and that's a question that was brought up at the meeting. There was a consultant that was there that says, yes, they will do that, that they made the comparison of, well, when you bring your child to the pediatrician for the first time, you have to fill out a lot of information about yourself and also your child so the pediatrician can best help your child and get a more well-rounded.
But I got to tell you, I've had to fill out those forms. I'm sure you have too when you go to the doctor, and I don't like filling them out.
Right.
I feel like it's none of your business. But I'll do it because you're my physician and there's certain things that you need to know. But my school principal is not my physician.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to fill – you won't have to. They'll use census data if you don't want to fill out and give up all that information.
So what conclusion did they reach about this? Have they decided how or what, how they're going to do this?
So there are a couple of factors that they are considering to determine socioeconomic status. Some of the things that they said that they could look at is whether a parent rents a home or buys or has purchased a home, how much the parent makes, also a parent's education status, if they've been to college, if they haven't. But these are things that they're going to start discussing at community meetings next week with parents of magnet school students.
And there's a whole list of these community meetings. They all take place, I think, between 6:30 and 8:30, and there's like 12 or 10 of them, and they're on the website at CMS because they want parents to come out and talk about this. And that's phase one. Phase two, we'll be talking about actual boundary changes for high school feeder schools as we go through the process of trying to break up these pockets of poverty, which we'll be talking about a lot in the coming year, I'm sure. This week, testimony of Kenneth Rudo, who is a state toxicologist that he gave as part of a deposition, became public. He said that health and environmental officials sought to play down the risk of coal ash contaminating drinking water wells near power plants, and that quickly got the attention of the governor's office. What happened?
Well, if you believe the testimony of Dr. Rudo, which is under dispute by the governor's office, the governor's office stepped in to advocate and ultimately persuade their administration to insert language that I assume your question is about how did that play out. But anyways, they went in and basically put in different language. And so right next to the "your water is probably dangerous and unsafe to drink" also says, "but other people say it's not dangerous and unsafe to drink." And I'm vastly paraphrasing.
And this is it's hard for me to understand what happened. But evidently, Mr. Rudo alleges that he was in a meeting or in giving his testimony with one of the governor's assistants, during which the governor called and the tone of the conversation instantly switched, and that's when this all happened. And the governor claims never to have made that phone call and never to have been involved in this meeting.
And it's interesting.
Is that right or wrong?
Well, the language is kind of important because the governor is saying that he never participated in that meeting.
Okay.
Now, Rudo says that the governor was on the phone. If you're on the phone but you don't say anything, is that... is that participating in a meeting? I don't know.
If you're in the room and don't say anything.
I suspect that there's some semantics going on here, but I think we had an editorial in the paper today. And basically what we're saying is that ultimately, whether he participated or didn't participate, or did he, you know, whisper some stuff over the phone, that's all kind of irrelevant at the end of the day. The fact is, this is a meeting that happened in the governor's office with one of his key aides.
Josh Ellis.
And this man, whether you believe him or not, and we've seen little to no evidence suggesting that he would just make this stuff up while under oath.
Right. Well, he's a toxicologist, a scientist, and he said that he in that deposition, he went on to paint a picture of what he described as unprecedented efforts by state health officials to give false assurance to well owners, saying, "We knowingly told people that their water was safe when we knew that it wasn't." The governor's office says he lied under oath.
And that's a pretty damning charge. Yeah. I think at the end of the day, and here's the problem, right, is so far no one, neither Dr. Ruto, who says his testimony is based on contemporaneous notes, nor the governor's office have come forward with any kind of actual evidence over what happened and how it happened yet, right? Although, trust me, I'm sure I'm just one of many reporters who are trying to get those documents through public records.
So if this is essentially a he said, she said at the moment, are there any records kept at these meetings on paper? Is anybody else coming forward who was in that meeting who could say one side or the other is correct?
Well, there was another official from the Department of Health and Human Services at that meeting, the one who called Dr. Ruto, and somehow, and that account of how that conversation went, somehow got him to that meeting. And she put out a statement this week that parsed words, you know, Eric was talking about the parsing of the governor's statement. Her statement also parsed words, and I kind of implied that the governor was on the phone with Josh Ellis, but not really as part of the meeting, but just while Josh was at the meeting, he was on. and so she enters a whole different thing. At the heart of this, though, is a disagreement over the definition of safe and unsafe water, or what counts as safe and unsafe water. And Ken Ruto, the scientist, was advocating for this scientifically sound, from a health and public health perspective, definition of unsafe.
Aren't they supplying bottled water to these people now?
Based on largely on these decisions that was made by DHHS, and ultimately the General Assembly has passed legislation that requires Duke to provide permanent alternative water sources now based on this. But, you know, the McCrory administration and DEQ specifically continues to point to the fact that the federal guidelines, of which practically there are none. If anyone from the McCrory administration is listening, they'll call me and tell me I'm wrong. But practically there are no specific guidelines, and the EPA is currently developing new guidelines to specifically address hexavalent chromium. So currently there's not one specific guideline for hexachrome, right? There is a blanket guideline for total chromium. There are two different types. So you can say with a straight face that this meets safe water standards, federal standards. You can say that right now because there are none. But Ruto is trying to develop a state standard pursuant to some law.
And hexavalent chromium being the carcinogen that comes from coal ash, coal ash water.
It is contained in coal ash, although Duke would also be quick to point out that it does and can occur naturally. But it is also – hexavalent chromium is the toxin in Aaron Brockovich for those who might be confused.
This is enough to drive people back to soda pop, I got to tell you. Let's continue talking about water for just a couple of seconds here. The U.S. National Whitewater Center has now cleaned up its act and disposed of the water that was contaminated by this amoeba that allegedly, I guess it's no longer alleged, I guess it's been proven that this Ohio teenager who visited the park had this amoeba go up her nose, and therefore she died from that infection. Mecklenburg County is now looking into being the agency that regulates the center. There's a question of whether the county has the legal authority to regulate a private enterprise. I didn't know they were a private enterprise. I thought county money went into the
There's a lot of county money in it, but it is ultimately private.
And county manager Dina DiOrio says we have two choices. We can let the state do it, or we can do it. There seems to be a reluctance on the part of a lot of people to regulate this place and how they clean the water. Why?
Well, one county commissioner at least said, well, this should be the Whitewater Center's problem. But then another one said, well, how do we know that they're going to hold it to a standard that we're okay with? So it seems like they're all arguing right now about what the best option is.
It's a tough situation because you're talking about a sort of hybrid institution of which there are very few. You know, you've got
– It was the first, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I believe so.
Yeah, yeah.
First one.
Yeah.
And
basically nobody quite knows how best to regulate this thing. So
and there are no national standards for such facilities because like one of the first in the country.
Yeah. So I for one am a little skeptical about the county being the agency to do it because I don't know that – do they have the expertise, the level of expertise to do this safely?
Well, does anyone?
I don't know.
Does anyone? Because, look, swimming pools are regulated, public and private, but this is not a swimming pool, and other things might be regulated. But it'll be interesting to see how regulators –
But it's still a body of – an enclosed body of water that has to be cleaned and people get in it. So how is it that different from a swimming pool?
Well,
maybe it's more like the lazy river.
6 million gallons is a huge swimming pool. That's what they just dumped into the Catawba River. Okay.
And the Whitewater Center does make a point of saying that, you know, this is not primarily for swimming. This is for kayaking, that kind of thing. But you do get soaked. Yeah. You can get soaked and you can go underwater.
And where does the Whitewater Center stand on this? Who do they want to regulate them?
That's
who do
a
they
good
want
question.
The, who
they're,
do they want the regulations to come from?
They remain very quiet.
I think
very
that
quiet.
Assumes they want some regulations, and they probably don't.
After this?
Have we ever met a private business that has said, yes, please come regulate me?
Wouldn't that take some of the onus off them if something happens in the future? We're just following regulations.
Well, then they may have to pay fines, and I don't know.
All right. Maybe well, we'll see how that unfolds because they've been very, very, very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
After the staff of the Charlotte Observer moved out and after weeks of preparation, crews this week began taking down the old Charlotte Observer building.
Eric's reaching
for the tissues.
What does it feel like, Eric, to see them dismantle a place in which you spent so much time and in which so much history was written about and perhaps even made?
Yeah, it's pretty sad. I literally have, not me, but I have had colleagues to shed some tears standing there looking out the window from the NASCAR tower where we have a bird's eye view of the, you know, the demolition equipment just, you know, going right at it and just
window view is something you didn't have in the old office.
This is true.
Well, usually when buildings are taken down, the organizations that used to occupy the buildings remove their name. The Observer did not. So you can see pictures of the Observer being crushed.
Yeah. There's
why would you do that?
There were
it's being used in a political campaign commercial by the governor now.
There were it is. And believe me, there were questions asked about this before this happened. Do we? Because actually, a lot of us wanted those letters from the side of the building.
Yes.
We wanted them to go in the new office.
Sure.
But I think that got caught up in the negotiations between the current ownership, Johnny Harris's company, and our people, and it just didn't happen.
Johnny Harris wants the letters in his office. Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, who could use some extra letters from time to time, one would think. You have to write every day. Hillary Byrne, staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News. And Sarah D'Elia, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.